Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Two shows about the gunfighters might seem kinda mad, but some folks just don't like it, which is really sad. So let us persuade you with an old Target book. And if you're still not converted, well, we don't give up. Hello. No, your ears are not deceiving you, and I'm not trying to trick you with my faultless American accent. I'm Jim Sangster, a co-producer of the Doctor Who Literature podcast, and I'll be your host for this episode, as our incredibly special guest is none other than our producer, Jason. Hello, Jason.
I was very tempted to do my least effective, most inaccurate UK accent for my own introduction, but I will just stick to my native Brooklyn, I think. I do not want to subject my viewers to that. One attempt at doing an Australian accent during an earlier episode about Tegan has taught me a lesson. Just don't even try.
As you know, I am fearless when it comes to accents. Fearless or stupid. So, obviously, we've swapped seats. You're on the rickety guest chair with the dodgy microphone, and I'm in the chair of power, and we've gone full Golga Fringe and B-Arc as we swap places to interview each other for this episode, because many, many moons ago when we were chatting, you said, I would really like to be the guest on this episode. And I said, oh, well, I'll fill in. So just to start us off, we've been inundated with a letter from Mrs. Trellis of North Wales that reads, Jason and Jim, I'm a long-term listener, and I would love to know, what is your favorite baseball game of all time? So I think you better start us off with that one, Jason.
Well, the obvious answer is Game 6 of the 1986 World Series, but as October 1986 is coming up very soon on this podcast, I will defer that story. The backup answer, and I'm sure you agree, but I'll ask you in a minute, the backup answer has to be Game 6 of the 1975 World Series. If you saw the movie Good Will Hunting 25 years ago, that game was a plot point in the movie. And they actually included footage from the NBC broadcast in the film. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck being native New Englanders. This was played in Boston at Fenway Park. Red Sox are playing the Cincinnati Reds, and it's a 7-game series. The Reds have won 3 of the first 5, but the Red Sox should have won all 5 of those games. They had the lead in every single one of them. A couple of bad umpire calls went against them. They had their best starter, who was nearly 40 years old, pitching in Game 6. They had a 3-0 lead early. Great defensive plays. They blew it. They're down 6-3 in the bottom of the 8th inning. 4 more outs, and they are eliminated from the World Series entirely. Once you lose 4 games, it's over. But the last man on their roster, this crazy guy named Bernie Carbo, had a dramatic 2-out, 3-run pinch home run in the bottom of the 8th. Ties the game at 6. 9th inning comes and goes. Nobody scores. More great legendary defensive plays. Now we're in extra innings. 10th inning, nobody scores. 11th inning, nobody scores. Bottom of the 12th, the Red Sox hometown boy, Carlton Fisk, their catcher, leads off the bottom of the 12th inning with a ball right down the foul line. If it goes foul, the foul ball, you got to do it over. If it stays fair, it's a home run. The cameraman in the left field scoreboard at Fenway Park, which is enormous, was being terrorized by an enormous rat the size of a pony. Fenway Park was at that point was over 60 years old, and there was a colony of rats that had grown to gargantuan size because of all the food discarded by the fans. These rats never went hungry. And this enormous rat the size of a pony enters the scoreboard room where the cameraman is, and he's terrified, and he freezes, and he accidentally catches Carlton Fisk dancing at home plate, trying to will the ball fair by doing this with his arms. And the ball hits the foul pole, means it's a home run. The organist starts playing Hallelujah, the Hallelujah chorus.
And Fisk will lead it off, has a single, and has walked twice. And the wind blowing out. There it goes, a long drive. If it stays fair, home run. We will have a 7th game in this 1975 World Series. A lot of body English for Carlton Fisk. Watch him.
How many steps does he take? One. He waits to see it. Get over. Get over.
He knew it. There it is.
Red Sox win the game in dramatic fashion, 7-6, ties the World Series. The Red Sox have not won the World Series in 57 years at this point, so the fans are desperate. Game 7 is being played at home. All the Red Sox have to do is win Game 7, and the World Series is theirs. That, of course, that's a story for another day, and they lost Game 7 in the most agonizing fashion possible, and they wouldn't win another World Series for 29 more years after that. So that's a pretty good game, pretty hard to top. Jim, you're going to do us one better. What is your favorite baseball game of all time?
Mine is the one where Bugs Bunny played all the positions on the field.
That's a good one, too.
Okay. So with that out of the way, the longer your answer got, the funnier I thought it was. So I just thought I'd leave it going. Right, so the Gunfighters. Speaking of, you know, one American cultural moment to another. Inevitably, we have to begin with a quote from 1983, from that review, from Doctor Who, A Celebration, where researcher Jeremy Bentham writes, "So badly was the show received by the public that its audience viewing figures dipped below the horizontal axis line on the ratings graph in the Doctor Who producer's office for the only time in the program's history." Now, I'm not going to bash Jeremy. He's a lovely chap. And he was working on limited research material and probably guided by anecdotes from people with very selective and biased memories. But this review seems to have shaped the opinions of fandom for many years. We now know it's not true. But why does this story have such a bad reputation among fans?
I got this story in late 1985. I'd been a fan for about a year, and New Jersey Network, which was one of the anchor PBS stations in the Northeast, got the Hartnell package first. They got, at the time, all 17 fully existing stories, the earliest being Unearthly Child, the latest being War Machines. So Gunfighters is, I think, 16th out of 17 in that package, probably airs January 1986, probably. Movie format version. So there's bespoke title credits, because instead of saying Holiday for the Doctor, it says The Gunfighter over the opening scene. Not The Gunfighters, but The Gunfighter. And bespoke 1985-style computer graphic closing credits that go one screen at a time rather than scrolling. That was my first exposure. I loved it. I loved the song. It didn't occur to me that the accents were bad, because one of the hallmarks of American comedy is doing exaggerated accents. I was just one of the few 12-year-old boys who loved watching black and white TV, because I had grown up with a black and white TV in my bedroom. I had no trouble adjusting to the fact that this is, at this point, a 19-year-old story. Black and white didn't faze me. Kids now will cheerfully watch reruns of things that are more than 19 years old. So The Gunfighters was a relic 19 years after it was made, where something like Friends is now 25 years old and it's still contemporary and lively. But again, I was not bothered by that. I really thought The Gunfighters was a fun story. Next week, The War Machines put me to sleep. And then after that, you have The Dominators was the first Troughton shown.
Oh my word!
So The Gunfighters was the last old Doctor Who story that I loved up until Mind Robber was screened about a month later. I didn't get my copy of A Celebration, and I still have it in the next room, probably spring 1986. And I read that review, and I'm like, oh, I must have been wrong. It must be a bad story then, because the book says so. To the extent that if you dig around the RecArch Doctor Who archives and you pull my very first review of The Gunfighters in the early 1990s, I gave it a 1.5-star review, not because I personally didn't like it, but because this book was the only book of Doctor Who criticism or critical reactions that I had for a long time. Oh, it must be true because I'm reading it here from somebody who's done a lot more research than I have. It was not until Discontinuity Guide comes out in 1995 that gives this story, I think, a much more accurate and fair airing. But I realized, wait a minute, it's okay to like The Gunfighters. I don't have to shape my review because this one book says so. So what boggles the mind is that this review is twice as old now as the Gunfighters was when I first saw it. Why does this single paragraph written in 1983 still have such sway over fandom, even though every other book that reviews the Gunfighters, this continuity guide, Running Through Carters, and the Elizabeth Sandifer material, every other book loves the Gunfighters. Why does this one paragraph still affect people?
Do you think it's partly because, having had that, where when you're growing up and you think, oh, Doctor Who's great, and then shortly after this book was published, we've got the cancellation. Within 2 years, we've got the cancellation. And suddenly Doctor Who is publicly rubbish. So a lot of fans are trying to make up for that by going, well, actually, the ones that we were told were rubbish aren't that bad, or are actually brilliant. And the ones that we were told are classics, like the Ice Warriors, is really dull, for example. Now, I probably saw this when it was repeated on the satellite channel BSB in the early 90s. But in the early 2000s, I had a group of friends in London, and we'd often meet for Doctor Who Club night, and we would only watch supposedly bad stories. We wouldn't watch much Philip Hinchcliffe because they're all kind of a muchness. But we decided one night that we were going to show our friends the Gunfighters. And we were surprised to discover that two leading lights of British fandom had never seen it, but they knew it was rubbish. And by the end of the evening, they said, well, that bloody song really does outstay its welcome. But that was so much fun. Hartnell was glittering on the screen. So brilliant. Dodo's great. Steven's amazing. It's really funny. But yeah, that song outstays its welcome. But maybe it wouldn't if we hadn't just watched it within a 2-hour block. So I'm going to suggest that people who slag it off nowadays haven't actually seen it.
And it's only parts 1 and 2 where the song has the same 3 verses over and over again. Once you get to parts 3 and 4, you have Rex Tucker writing his own verses, and the ballad gets very, very funny because the lyrics change. So people who complain about the ballad, I think, are sort of missing the mark.
And then, of course, we've got the great lie that this had the lowest ratings, audience ratings, ever. And we know ultimately this means that what is actually going on was the appreciation index. And the appreciation index is a bit of a lie in itself, just because it's a very small sample of about 2,000 people who are being asked to comment on something that they probably wouldn't have chosen to watch. So they're already unwilling viewers. And the one positive in it is that everyone is marked in the same way. But it just means that certain niche programs or certain genre programs tend to score a little bit lower than the more mass market, big budget dramas. But we were talking recently about the lie of the Gunfighters being the lowest rated story anyway, weren't we? We came up with a fascinating discovery that, okay, up to that point, only An Unearthly Child had lower ratings. But The Gunfighters isn't even the lowest rated story of that season, because there are going to be 3 stories more that follow it that get lower ratings. Actually, Gunfighters is the 13th lowest placed story up to 1983. And obviously everything post 1985 knocks it even higher up the charts to a respectable 27th place. So why do people still persist in perpetuating that lie?
There is the story told on the DVD infotech that they did have to create a second sheet of graph paper to track the audience appreciation index on the producer's office. So again, he's conflating the audience appreciation with the viewer ratings. I think what he's saying is emotionally true, even if he's conflating. There was a chart that had to be added onto to reflect how low it was. And 13th lowest rated story for the first 20 years of the show is still pretty bad. However, as you and I have discussed, since nobody knows what the quality of the show is going to be when they turn or don't turn on the TV on the original broadcast day, ratings are no indicator of quality at all. And also, if it is a summer day, and it's a beautiful sunny day outside, and it's 5 p.m. on a Saturday, you're not racing home to watch an American Western. You're staying outside to reenact a Western at the park or on your front stoop. So the fact that it's a low-rated story is meaningless. The fact that it had low audience appreciation numbers, well, clearly these fans weren't familiar with the language of the Western up to that point. Because as far as Westerns go, this is an incredibly faithful and loving bit of work. Now, the novelization is a different story. The novelization is a parody, but the TV episodes, which is primarily what we're discussing right now, is exactly of a piece with every Western movie or TV series that came before it, to the extent that there are lines of dialogue in this directly taken from 1957's Gunfight at the OK Corral, starring Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. Which, by the way, means that Doc Holliday in both that movie and this episode are both Jewish, so represent.
And as we discussed in the last episode, it's not even that Westerns were an incredibly popular genre, but musical Westerns were a hell of a lot more common than we might expect. And also, Westerns with a theme tune sung by a popular, well, a pop musician, basically. One thing that we realized as we were building up to this is that even in the UK, where obviously people criticize this for being a British attempt at an American genre, but one of Gerry Anderson's first puppet series was Four Feather Falls, which was a Western. And it had a theme tune by Michael Holliday, which is, he was a pop star at the time.
Two Gun Techs of Texas will never let you down. But play it bad and he'll get mad. So cover your tracks from Two Gun Techs, the smartest guy in town. The smartest guy in town.
And it also starred Nicholas Parsons as Tex Tucker. And Nicholas Parsons obviously became a Doctor Who person many years later. But a lot of the voices were also done by David Graham. Now, for Doctor Who fans, and especially North American Doctor Who fans, you might know him from this, and as as Charlie the Barman, and also as Kerensky in City of Death. But in the UK, he voiced some of the most popular characters in children's entertainment ever, including Parker in Thunderbirds. Of course, David Graham was also one of the first Daleks.
And to do a rundown of musical Westerns, obviously you have Gene Autry, the singing cowboy, who later was the owner of the Los Angeles Angels, later California Angels baseball team for the first 40 years of their existence. So there's your singing cowboy / baseball crossover. Second time we brought up baseball this hour. The movie High Noon has a ballad, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, sung by Tex Ritter, who was a legend. Tex Ritter's son, by the way, sitcom legend in America, John Ritter. Tex Ritter's grandson, Jason Ritter, still a very popular actor today. So there's a dynasty for you. 1957, Gunfight at the OK Corral. Frankie Lane, who was a very popular singer of the day, does the ballad throughout the 1957 film. And might I add, not nearly as lively and as funny as the Linda Barron version in this.
Here they lie side by side, the killers that died in the gunfight at OK Corral. OK Corral.
OK. And I'm sure this was not a direct influence on Donald Cotton, but the long-running American Western series, The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, starring Hugh O'Brien. At least the early episodes that I've seen, I have not watched the whole series, the early episodes that I've seen have a ballad that plays three or four times throughout the episode and tells the story.
Oh, Wyatt Earp, Wyatt Earp, brave, courageous, and bold. Long live his fame, and long live his glory, and long may his story be told.
So the Western and the ballad are just two things that go together. You don't say one without the other. The ballad in this story is proof that this is a legitimate, authentic Western, and the fans who are criticizing it might not understand the genre that they're in.
It's even down to the fact that when they were producing this and Rex Tucker couldn't really get a handle on it, until Innes Lloyd says, just make it like Cat Ballou. So he's already directing it as another musical Western. But funny enough, Rex Tucker did actually watch the Gunfight at OK Corral movie in preparation for this. We should also do an honorable mention for Carry On Cowboy, the film that was released the year before this came out. So, funnily enough, they got rid of historicals because, allegedly, because of this story. So, was Innes Lloyd right to phase them out?
I want to answer that, but let's just backtrack a moment. Two other points that I needed cultural translation for in the Jeremy Bentham paragraph. He says the acting is more West Ham than West Hollywood. I had no idea what that meant in 1986. Then he says the script is pure Talbot Rothwell. When he says this, you can imagine in the most sneering tone of voice possible. In 1986, I would not have known who Talbot Rothwell was, other than to think that this is an insult and he must be a terrible person who murdered puppies and kittens for fun. When I got the Elizabeth Standifer book, at least 10 years ago now, that actually explained to me who Talbot Rothwell was, one of the titans of British cinematic comedy, so not really a bad name to compare to.
Well, again, the author of all the Carry On movies, and Carry On Cowboy starred John Pertwee, by the way. But yeah, there's a subtext here as well, in that Doctor Who fans are notoriously lacking a sense of humor often. And the fact that The Gunfighters is unashamedly and intentionally a comedy until the point when, like The Mythmakers, it suddenly isn't. So it's often the way that whenever you get a lighthearted story that is trying to be funny, a lot of fans take against it and dislike it. So that line there about Talbot Rothwell is definitely Jeremy Bentham's sense of humor deserting him temporarily, hopefully. The other thing, I mean, West Ham, a football team, you guys would say soccer, but I'm not playing to that game. But that's a really weird pun, because West Ham, you would imagine that he's attacking the acting. But I don't think he's really, well, he's attributing the direction was more West Ham than West Coast. So he's making a pun on the word West rather than Ham. Perhaps because he'd already used the acting was not even bad vaudeville. Anyway, I'm criticizing his writing, and it's 40 years ago, and that's probably not fair.
There was no bad vaudeville. This is where you get, I won't even go into it. Milton Berle, any great American actor of the mid-20th century got started in vaudeville. So that is not the flex he thinks it is.
And also William Hartnell, and also John Pertwee. But the fact that he says it was not good, it was bad, and it was ugly, it's a nice little pun. Getting a Western pun in there. But I don't think he's right. No. Anyway.
I am contractually obligated to mention that Eli Wallach's autobiography is titled The Good, The Bad, and Me, because he realized to his chagrin when he showed up on set that when the movie was called The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly, he was cast as The Ugly. And he grew up a few neighborhoods over in Brooklyn from where I am now. He gives his childhood home address in his autobiography. I've been there a zillion times. Part of my Brooklyn home base, that neighborhood. So, yeah, it's a good pun. It's a good way of working it in and getting your Eli Wallach reference in there. But to answer your original question, I'm doing a terrible job of answering questions, but I like Gunfighters so much, my being defensive of it means I have to go all over the map. Kind of like the accents in this story, but I'm pish. Yes, Innes Lloyd is 100% correct to get rid of the historical, and I'll tell you why. The next historical after this is The Smugglers, and we talked about this last week in part one of this episode. In isolation, The Smugglers is a good, fun story. When you watch it in sequence, in between The War Machines and The Tenth Planet and The Power of the Daleks, The Smugglers is a sad little irrelevancy. It is frustrating. It is boring. I want my Michael Ferguson direction. I want my sweeping crane shots of London. I want my enormous killer robots. I want my Cybermen. I want my Daleks. I want my Patrick Troughton reinventing the role of the Doctor. The Smugglers doesn't work. The Highlanders, which we covered on this show recently, Daniel Knight was my guest, and he gave us a virtual walking tour of the Highlands itself. The Highlanders is a story that doesn't know what it wants to be when it grows up. And it's the opposite of the Gunfighters, that it goes from dark tragedy in the first 10 minutes to farce. And unlike the Gunfighters, the Joins are very uneasy, almost as if the writer is telling the wrong story. So the Highlanders is the last historical until Black Orchid, which many fans also hate. So yeah, they had already told the best historical stories they could. And it's a finite genre. And the Gunfighters was the best one, possibly. The best comedy historical, certainly. The next two after that were not as good. And they don't hold up as well. And Ines Lloyd is right that science fiction is the show of the future. When he ditches the historicals, we get the Cybermen in their place. And nobody's going to argue that Doctor Who would be better without the Cybermen, who are still with us in a very strong way in the 21st century story. So as much as Jeremy Bentham is wrong for poisoning three generations of fans against historicals, Ines Lloyd did do the right thing for the future of the show.
And strangely, we've had this kind of celebrity historical trend for quite a while, where you've got, you know, you're meeting someone who's famous from that point in history. But when we get our first pseudo historical with the Time Meddler, we don't have any actual famous hook in there, do we? There's no actual celebrity from history in there. Then we get the Gunfighters, which has probably got the most real, like the cast is made up of real people, or at least the legend that was based on real people who existed, even down to Kate, who apparently was a woman known as Big Nose Kate. I'm sure that was affectionate. I'm sure that wasn't a horrible nickname. But from this point, you don't really get like the celebrity historical anymore, even if they dip in time for a genre like smuggling, or you know the Jacobite Rebellion. You don't get any celebrities in there, and it's only even with Black Orchid, there's no actual real people in there. It's only when you get to something like Mark of the Rani, where there are actually a surprising number of people who really did exist, who were name checked or actually appear on screen. I think Russell T. Davis got the right idea, where he just realised that we do need a celebrity to hook it on, so that we can experience history through the eyes of someone we might have heard of.
And then you hire big name actors to play these celebrities. You have Goran Visnjic, you have Simon Callow. So the celebrity casting for the new series has been on point, but even then you need to have some sci-fi element in the celebrity historical to give your celebrity something interesting to react against. I will go into it more in the second half of the essay, but the historical accuracy of the Gunfighters obviously is completely incorrect. Wyatt Earp was possibly something of a fabulist. He kept the story of the OK Corral alive because he lived for another 45 years and he made it to Hollywood. And the story is told from his point of view. The names of the Earps and the Clantons are not properly used within the story itself. And there are some corrections made for the novelization, but even those corrections are wrong. Bat Masterson is possibly the only person in this story of whom we have actual moving film footage. Like Wyatt Earp, Wyatt Earp was controversially a very bad referee for a title fight in 1896. But these are for the most part real people, even if they're out of context. Big Nose Kate has a fascinating life story that I'm going to get into at depth on the other side of the break. So these are real people, and in the case of Bat Masterson, you can actually watch film footage of them in reality, except that Bat Masterson was nowhere near Tombstone. It had nothing to do with the story, so his presence in this story is one of the least accurate parts of it. Making my third and final baseball reference of the hour, New York-based sports writer Alan Barra, Barra, not to be mistaken for Baseball Hall of Famer Yogi Berra, who later inspired the cartoon character Yogi Bear. Alan Barra was the sports writer for the Village Voice, and he's written several books about baseball, but he also wrote a straight biography of Wyatt Earp, which came out in 1999 or 2000. And it is a fact-from-fiction retelling of the Wyatt Earp story. And for the sake of the book, he actually bought the VHS of the Gunfighters, possibly charging it to his publisher, and he reviewed the Gunfighters in two or three paragraphs in this best-selling biography. He was very harsh on the story, not understanding the humor and not understanding the historical inaccuracy. So in defense of Jeremy Bentham, it is not even the worst review of the Gunfighters that has been committed to print. Hey guys, this is Jason from the future. So I tried to track down a copy of that Alan Barra book, just to give you a sample of what he said about Doctor Who for the podcast. There does not appear to be a Kindle version that I can buy, but you can actually search the text of the book on Amazon and get some sample pages. The Doctor Who material in the book takes up two different pages, and I was only able to find one page on Amazon, so I will now do a Jim Sangster style impromptu reading, although unlike Jim, I am not able to do it in character. And he starts off discussing the Star Trek Season 3 episode Spectre of the Gun, which came out a couple of years after the Gunfighters. Quote, "Oddly enough, the Star Trek episode was not the first Wyatt Earp foray into science fiction. Ken Leibowitz, a New York collector of Earpiana, located a 1966 videotape of an episode of the British series Doctor Who," although he spells it DR period Who, back to the book, "entitled Doctor Who and the Gunfighters. For those unfamiliar with the show, which was syndicated in the United States for several years, Doctor Who is a time traveler and historical investigator, somewhat in the manner of Dr. Peabody and Sherman of the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon show. His stop in Tombstone 1881 is an accident. Returning to England in 1966 from somewhere in the past, he's suddenly overcome by a toothache and lands his time travel ship next to the OK Corral to look for a dentist. Doc Holliday, who was raised in Alabama, is trying to settle down and open a respectable dental practice, but Johnny Ringo and the Clantons are after him because he killed the youngest Clanton brother, Reuben. Bat Masterson, the sheriff of Tombstone, and Wyatt Earp, the marshal of Tombstone, try to keep Doc and the Clantons apart while Doctor Who gets his tooth fixed. The Doctor gets his tooth fixed, and there's an ineptly staged shootout. What's fascinating about this atrociously..." And unfortunately, the Amazon sample does not give the next page. I recall from memory, having read this book nearly 25 years ago, that he spends the next page detailing all the historical inaccuracies. But that is a sample of what an American sports writer is thinking about Doctor Who. And now let's get back to our program, already in progress.
So, on to the book. And once again, Donald Cotton goes hugely off script. How many liberties can Donald Cotton get away with before it stops being Doctor Who?
It's very similar to Mythmakers, actually. If you look at the dialogue alone, the dialogue is pretty faithful to what we get on television before rehearsal. Wyatt Earp is not called Werp at all in this story. That is a vintage William Hartnell style joke, and he carries it off very well. So that sort of thing is not in the book. Everything else from episodes 1, 2, and most of episode 3 is pretty faithful to the TV script. I will discuss some of the more notable deviations on the other side of the break. But same as with Mythmakers, you get the sense that he did not have at hand a copy of the camera scripts for part 4 when he was writing this thing. Because part 1, dialogue is faithful. Part 2, dialogue is faithful. Part 3, dialogue is faithful. Part 4 is reduced to about a dozen pages of text and has almost no similarity. It's the prose where he really goes off script. This prose, and I'll discuss it more in the context of Pulp Fiction. I talked about this a little bit last week when I was talking about Louis L'Amour and the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. This is not what pulp prose sounds like. He is just... every sentence needs to be 3 times as long as a regular sentence. There needs to be a bad pun or a joke in every sentence. So you get the sense that he's making fun of Westerns in general. It's a bizarre style of writing. In the Mythmakers, it works very well. especially the anachronisms, because then you get the sense that Homer became a companion of the Doctor later on and would have seen all these anachronisms firsthand. Here, and I'll be detailing all the anachronisms, unless you take my theory from last week that Ned Buntline's ghost is actually the writer of this thing, because the actual Ned Buntline was dead by the time Doc Holliday had his final day in 1887. Unless you take that ghost theory, there's really no reason for the anachronisms in this script. I think he's amusing himself and not worrying so much about, is this going to be a serious book?
And I think Donald Cotton has a real flair for just breaking all the rules, but also we always boast that Doctor Who can go anywhere and go to any time and any genre, except the genres we don't like. You know, I think a lot of fans might look at, say, a Western as something that their dad liked. So in the same way that you're a bit of an anomaly in liking sport, because a lot of Doctor Who fans really don't like sport, there's not a lot of love for Westerns because it feels a bit normal and a bit safe. So I wonder if there's something in that. The fact that as well, when you look at the ratings are fairly consistent all the way through. It's just people didn't show up for episode one. And didn't come back, and actually didn't come back until next season, because I think possibly the Daleks maybe exhausted them.
And if they didn't see episode one, they wouldn't have had any reason to dislike the story at all, because they wouldn't even have seen the setup as to what it was all about, which means that it was probably the last four episodes before this, the Celestial Toymaker, that may have exhausted people's patience, and that was the genre Doctor Who should never have tried to do.
A Billy Bunter alike shouting Yaru is what did for Doctor Who. I have to be honest, I've not researched what was on the other side, so I don't know what ITV had put up against it. So the fact that this was shown the end of April to the beginning of May, it might have been a sunny day, as you mentioned earlier. It might also have just been, as with season 18, ITV had strong opposition. When a lot of people say, oh, look, people knew that John Nathan Turner was going to be terrible because they didn't watch his episodes. Well, they didn't know he was going to be terrible if they didn't watch it.
Right.
They just happened to be watching the other side, because for the first time ever, ITV was showing the same thing in most of its regions in the UK. And as soon as they did that, they went, hey, we destroyed Doctor Who. And everyone was watching us because they're all tuning in at the same time, rather than, as they traditionally did, have different programs in each of the regions in the UK.
When we finally get the Black Archive volume on the Gunfighters, I'm sure a lot of that will be answered, but I have no way of doing that kind of research myself. I wouldn't even know where to begin, so I rely on you for that.
I hope somebody is doing it. I mean, I was told that they're not doing every story. They're not planning on doing every story with them. That's what Target said. But then I was told that in a rejection letter, so maybe we don't want to go into that.
How could you not do the Gunfighters, though? It's such an iconic, well-known, even if infamous, story. It's the kind of story you figure folks would want to read a critical monograph of.
But I don't know whether there's a story in the writing of it. So maybe that's it. You know, it seems to have been delivered quite quickly. I think Donald Cotton seems to be quite good at just bashing them out and making them entertaining from the word go. So I don't know, but we'll find out if they do a Black Archive.
There's a lot to discuss there. You talk about the history of the Western / musical. You talk about the actual historicality, not even historicity, of the gunfight at the OK Corral. You talk about the novelization. You talk about the Jeremy Bentham review and why this was singled out as the worst. What's even funny about A Celebration is every other paragraph review that he writes for every other story from 1963 to 1983 is courteously deferential at worst. The worst thing he can say about The Monster of Peladon is that it's a sequel. The worst he can say about Underworld is it's less remembered than other stories because of the CSO effect. The Gunfighters is the only story out of those first 20 seasons that he actually goes to town hating on. So this story is in a whole other quantum of detested stories. A really good Black Archive writer could take that apart and examine it and just prove that Jeremy Bentham has had an unfortunate influence on the way the story is perceived.
The story that follows this, The Savages, Jeremy describes as the only flaw visible in the story was its lack of a monster. Otherwise, it would deservedly be far better remembered than it is today. I think arguably it would be better remembered if we could see it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a strange thing. Like, I wonder if the gunfighters would be more or less appreciated if it was missing. Maybe it would be lauded, but maybe just the audio and the fact that it's got that song, maybe it would outstay its welcome even more. I don't know.
I think once you just hear the actors reciting the rapid-fire dialogue with relish and freed from black and white visuals, even though the DVD correctly points out Rex Tucker did a phenomenal job directing the story with a tower camera in the studio, and there's actually two extras in part one who are on the background of every scene on multiple sets. You can imagine they're acting out their own little drama in the background. It's very carefully directed, but the dialogue is so rapid fire. And if you can hear the ballad for what it is, how it gets very funny verses in episodes 3 and 4, I think the story would shine on audio.
Now, we're fans of Donald Cotton, I think, aren't we? We quite like him, even though he's quite irregular. But could you imagine him adapting another historical instead of whoever adapted it for Target? In the same way that he didn't write the Romans, but he adapted it quite nicely.
I hate to out myself as a purist or a traditionalist, because those are bad words, but I like novelizations that are generally faithful to the TV story, because when I was a kid and I'm reading the novelization of A Missing Story that I'll never ever get a chance to watch, and at the time would never even have known that I'd have a chance to watch animation or hear the audio, I wanted to know, where are the cliffhangers? What was the story like to watch? That's why I love the novelization of Galaxy 4, because it's 4 chapters for 4 episodes, each with the cliffhanger in place. Same with Web Planet, 6 episodes, 6 chapters. And when you read a book that deviates significantly from the TV story, like Marco Polo or The Massacre, I found that a little disappointing. If Donald Cotton were to take a run-of-the-mill historical, like The Smugglers, or I don't want to say The Crusade is run-of-the-mill, but if he were to take a story like that and write a out-there script where the prose, where the humor intrudes on the narrative of the story, I'm not positive that that's going to work. To wit, I read the novelization of the Romans once when it came out in the late 80s. I hated it, and I have not read it since. And I'm very curious, when I get to the Romans again in a few months on this podcast, will I like it any better the second time around? That's one of the biggest unanswered questions for me. Along with The Rescue, which I think is the one novelization that I have never read. So I'm curious to see how Donald Cotton will hold up when it comes to the Romans. My only memory of that from 35 years ago is that I hated his book.
I hope you're going to be impressed. I hope, having read the other two stories, I hope you're really going to be impressed, because I think it's a lot of fun. But I'm also struggling to imagine which historical he might have done next, because you've got those Lucarotti books, and they are gorgeous. You know, you can tell he's putting a lot of effort in a way that, say, Brian Hales isn't in The Ice Warriors. And the same with Ian Marta. You know, him doing The Reign of Terror, the French Revolution, and not making it a bloodbath, even though there's some gory scenes in it, you know, it shows a lot of restraint. And then we've got The Rescue, which is, yeah, heavily edited with all the sexual innuendo he was trying to force into it.
And Ian Marta rethinks The Reign of Terror. You know, how are these characters speaking French? He is thinking about why the story is unfolding the way it does. He's treating it as a straight historical. What does it mean that Ian and Barbara only speak passing French and have trouble communicating? I can't imagine Donald Cotton would have done that.
He would have made it funny. So that would be the thing, which would probably have been very much like another famous Carry On movie. So I'm going to just ask you now, is the book of the Gunfighters better than the TV show?
No.
Well, that's the end of the show.
I can tell that's the answer you didn't want to hear. What I love about the Gunfighters is William Hartnell, Peter Purvis, Jackie Lane. I think we talked about this last week. Dodo has never been better than she is in this story. She beats Doc Holliday at his own game. She holds a gun on him. She forces him to change his mind. And then on TV, we learn that he had a second gun concealed in his coat. And when she sees that, she faints. But when he brings her back to the sheriff's office and says, "This young lady has defeated me," Jackie Lane holds up her gun arm and does a pirouette. And if your heart doesn't melt at that, you are made of stone. That's one of the best bits of companion acting ever. And you have to credit Jackie Lane with that because it's not scripted. I love the ballad, which is only in one page of the book. I love the humor, which, as we've discussed, a lot of that is William Hartnell's embellishments. Rex Tucker's direction, you have William Hartnell reading Johnny Ringo's wanted poster in episode 2. And that becomes Chekhov's wanted poster, because if you see a wanted poster in episode 2, the felon pictured thereon must show up in episode 3. Whereas in the book, that's taken away and the doctor doesn't even know who Johnny Ringo is. So the book is interesting in its own right, but everything I love about the TV story is absent from the book. So I'd rather just watch the TV serial all over again, truth be told. Now you're going to tell me why I'm wrong.
No. I love the book because it is an anomaly, and unusually because it's one of the few historicals that we've actually got to watch. So it makes sense to have an alternative. In the same way that the Romans, we've got the Romans, and so it makes sense to have another version of it because we can now watch them on video. But I think one thing I'd say about the Gunfighters, because this is a moment of transition as well, as we said last time, and we were trying to be as fair as we could with John Wells and with Donald Tosh, but neither of them really wanted to be there. And we've now got a new production team, and Innes Lloyd initially didn't want to be there, but he had the strength to turn Doctor Who into what he wanted to make. But he also had Jerry Davis, who really did want to be there. And I think it's very telling that as soon as they both take over properly, Dodo's better, the Doctor's better. Clearly, William Hartnell must have had a better relationship with Innes Lloyd because he seems to know what he was doing. He seemed to command respect rather than try to demand it. And William Hartnell in The Gunfighters is fantastic, and he's so much fun.
You get no sense from watching this that he is 6 months away from being fired. I have been binge watching Dark Shadows 2 episodes a night for the last 7 months now, and I've got about 13 more months to go before I run out of series. 1,225 episodes. I just watched 417 and 418 last night. There are very good American actors who have come out of the New York and Hollywood soap opera scene. Dark Shadows was filmed in New York. There's a couple of actors in that who later go on to very long careers. Harvey Keitel was an extra in an early episode, for example. But most of them are jobbing off-Broadway actors who are taking the soap gig to pay some bills. There are some actors in there that you could see are just barely memorizing their line, just doing this for the paycheck. And you can tell when they're going to get fired because they're putting nothing on camera other than the words on the teleprompter. Whereas you have an actor like Mitchell Ryan, who was the bad guy in Halloween 6, which I do not recommend, although with Donald Pleasence and Mitchell Ryan and Paul Rudd, his movie debut, Halloween 6 may have the best cast of any Halloween movie, even though it's the worst of the 13. Great actor, got a start in Dark Shadows, got fired for being an alcoholic. His replacement was terrible and got fired 6 months after Mitchell Ryan got fired. So you're not guaranteed to have a good acting performance. William Hartnell in The Gunfighters is better than anything you will see in Dark Shadows anywhere. And it's hard to imagine that he got fired shortly after this because he's so good and he's giving exactly what the script demanded. His problem is that the comedy historical is where he excelled. That was his wheelhouse. Science fiction, he's lost at sea in something like The Web Planet, where he doesn't understand the dialogue. And that was the kind of story Jerry Davis and Innes Lloyd wanted to tell. So there's less room for him in a high-tech story like 10th Planet or War Machines. And that's probably the reason why he had to go. He wasn't the kind of actor who could do sci-fi as well as he could do comedy, and there were going to be no more comedies under his board.
It's a real shame, isn't it? Hey Bill, you were really good in this historical comedy, but we're not going to be doing this anymore. So we don't really have room for you. Oh, never mind. We still love you, Bill. So I'm going to say something to you now that we've not said on this show for quite a while. It's time for a game. So I'm going to read out three hastily written limericks, and you just have to guess the last word. To make it easier, these all relate to this week's subject. Are you ready?
And longtime listeners of the American NPR, National Public Radio game show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, will recognize this as the Listener Limerick Challenge. Take it away, Jim.
As the facts are more often forgotten, fans think that this story is rotten. This musical western, our patience it's testing, in a script written by
Donald Cotton.
Yeah!
That's a good limerick. You are definitely, considering that your fellow producer David Barsky was not a fan of my earlier limericks, I think maybe you're going to be hired as our permanent limerick writer.
It just frightens me when we've been on other podcasts and I hear people's attempts at limericks and I think, you don't understand how it scans, do you? You don't understand the scansion. So, right. Number two. These are really painful. While hysterical to some extent, the gunfighters narrates with lament. The actors yee-haw as they enter the bar with no hint of American
accent. See, here's the trick to solving the listener limerick challenge. You only have to listen to the first sentence, and then you pick any word relevant to the story that rhymes with the last word of the first sentence. You don't even have to listen to the next four, next three lines. But when you say extent, that puts the emphasis on the second syllable, to coin a phrase. Whereas I say accent rather than extent. So I was actually thrown off for that one. And I had to listen to the whole thing to figure out what the answer was going to be.
Oh, I'm cheating all the way through to make these work. So, at the Last Chance Saloon, you can bet that a gunfight is no idle threat. As old Charlie's till rings to the tune Dodo sings with piano by Stephen
Regret.
Yeah. You are far too good at this. Go to move 903.
But now by invoking the ghost of Celestial Toymaker, which we have established as a show that murdered Doctor Who in the ratings for all time, hopefully that doesn't do for my ratings what that did for Celestial Toymaker and Doctor Who.
Well, we're going to shift to a production code round. So, as you know, all stories of the classic era were allocated a code, so that during production, the team knew what they were talking about, even if the overall title changed. Indeed, much of the original paperwork would refer solely to codes, not titles, and The Gunfighters was the final story in the original run of codes being Story Z. I said what I said, I'm not translating. So, you need to tell me, and we've got three rounds of this, which story goes with these production codes? To start you off, I'm going for a P.
Probably the greatest Easter egg on any Doctor Who DVD is the Scottish falsetto sock puppet theater, which shows up on three or four discs. And even though my opinion on the Dominator is well known in Doctor Who literature nation, as opposed to Fraser and Andrew Smith, I will never ever get rid of my Dominators DVD, even after the Blu-ray comes out, because the Scottish falsetto sock puppet theater is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. No matter what I watch it, I am doubled over in laughter, because story code humor really is you have to be a certain breed of fan to appreciate story code humor. And we're talking about story code P, there would have been a time when I knew this. I think P has to be right around Galaxy 4, doesn't it?
Is that your guess?
I would have known this, Cole, before my copy of the program guide was thrown away by my mother-in-law, but I don't know for sure, so I'm going to say it is, in fact, Galaxy 4.
So, remember that the story that followed it has its own unique code, doesn't it?
Oh, wait, you're right. So, wait, so Galaxy, you're right, Galaxy 4 is T, because Mission to the Unknown is T oblique A. So that means that working backwards, PQRST, it's four stories before Galaxy 4. That would make it the Space Museum?
Ah! No, I'm afraid you've squatted out on this one. It's the Crusades.
Okay.
Or as they called it on the paperwork, Story P. The next one is JJJ.
This I know because in the early days of my novelization collecting, I would write the story code on the inside front page of the novelization because I had recently gotten the Lofficier program guide, and that's when I learned about story codes. So I believe it's my copy of The Demons that has JJJ poorly inscribed on the front page.
Which is a bit like a Spanish person laughing. Ja, ja, ja. And finally, the greatest story code of all time. I'm sure you know this is coming, so I'm going to be very careful how I pronounce it. 4Q.
See, I thought you were going with triple X, which used to be the rating for pornographic films in the States before 1990.
And why?
Our mutual friend Karina Longworth made the observation that there was no triple X rating, but films would use triple X to show that it was even worse than X. And triple X, I was quite prepared to answer, is Death to the Daleks. But my mother grew up in Brooklyn and had a very Brooklyn sense of humor, would tell me this joke when I was far too young. And the joke was, if you see Kay, tell her I'm in apartment 4Q. And that was the creative way that girls at the Yeshiva of Flatbush would curse each other out in the 1950s. So when I got my program guide and saw story 4Q, I immediately showed my mother. I think that's somewhere in the neighborhood of Face of Evil.
You'd be right. Well done. Well done. So you only lost 1 point on there. And that's probably why we haven't done this segment for a while. But that brings this segment to a close. And I think it's time to mop up the sawdust. So thank you very much for being my guest this week. And in the words of Donald Cotton, as performed by Linda Barron and then completely rewritten by me, you've played all my games now, and that's quite a score. We've spent 2 weeks in Tombstone, so we don't need more. Next week, it's Atlantis, with Pertwee at last. So join me on the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. Cue the music.
You are invited on an adventure across all of time and space. In a completely random order. It's the Police Box in the Junkyard podcast. Jump in the TARDIS with your hosts,
Eric Gulbranson,
Asad Cheshki,
and
Matthew Kressel.
Explore Doctor Who TV stories, audio adventures, and books, both novels and non-fiction. The Police Box in the Junkyard podcast. It's the entire Whoniverse. On Shuffle. The Police Box in the Junkyard podcast is a member of the Direction Point Network and is available about once a month wherever you find your podcasts. You are listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast.
Doctor Who, The Gunfighters, by Donald Cotton. Televised as The Gunfighter. For Real, that was the PBS omnibus title in the 80s, teleplay by Donald Cotton, televised in April and May 1966, paperback release date January 9th, 1986, target book number 101, cover artist Andrew Skilleter. back in the gun-toting, hard-hitting, fast-shooting days of the old Wild West, when outlaws ruled the land and the good guys stayed off the streets, a troupe of traveling players, Miss Dodo DuPont, Stephen Regret, and the mysterious Dr. Caligari, moseyed into the town of Tombstone one October afternoon. Their method of transportation was a mite peculiar, though. After all, a police box, materializing out of thin air, sure ain't the usual way to enter a sedate town like Tombstone. And when the doctor and his partners meet up with Wyatt Earp and the notorious Clanton brothers, they soon find out that the scene is all set for high noon at the OK Corral. The prose in the novelization of the gunfighters is insane, exhausting, all over the place. As we touched on briefly in the prologue to this audio essay, in last week's episode 101A, if I were to detail every bit of clever wordplay or pun deployed by Donald Cotton over the course of these 146 pages, this audio essay would be 2 hours long. Even more so than the Mythmakers novelization, episode 97, Cotton's prose is a fever dream of similes, puns, bewildering references totally unmoored in time to the book's October 1881 setting, and while the material covering the first 3 episodes is fairly faithful to the TV, and thus is probably based on the last scripts that Cotton submitted before the actors got them in rehearsal, once again Cotton completely ignores what happens in episode 4, and just spends about 12 to 15 pages telling a completely different version of events. Here is one typical bonkers sentence from chapter 1, quote, "The doctor was already clutching at an apparently haphazard selection of levers with the art of a demented xylophonist who finds he's brought along the wine list instead of the score." I'm sure that makes sense somehow, though I'm not inclined to think too hard on it. That's the TLDR, as the kids say. If that's all you care to know about the Gunfighters novelization, this is probably a good place to check out. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. But for everyone else, most of the rest of this essay will be an encyclopedia, a glossary, an explanation of all of Cotton's 19th century pop culture references, anachronisms, and most egregious deviations from the televised material. The first 130 pages are so, again, fairly faithful to the TV, though missing all of Hartnell's body language-infused humor and references to Mr. Werp and such. Hartnell is so much better on TV than in this book. Unlike the TV, the book opens with a TARDIS scene. The doctor has a toothache, the TARDIS materializes in the OK Corral itself, and Dodo closes the chapter shooting, "Whoopee! We're in a Western!" We sure are. Cotton will bring his receipts to prove it. From chapter 2, Seth Harper, arguably the only honorable bad guy on TV, here is described as a back shooter, so we're clearly not dealing with Shane Rimmer's reluctantly likable black hat. While the book mostly eschews the ballad, my beloved ballad, Cotton does print 2 verses in chapter 2, so at least the ballad gets some play. Enter Wyatt Earp in chapter 3. In real life, Wyatt is buried in a Jewish cemetery in California, courtesy of his final wife, Josephine Marcus, but the book envisions him as a fire and brimstone preacher. Page 25, and this is good prose, a tall man he was, lean, and with the flickering hellfire eye of a misogynist Methodist preacher. He leant over the sway back of a skeletal horse, as though it was the pulpit rail of the last tin chapel left standing in Gemara, and in his black gloved hand was a smoking pistol with a 12-inch barrel. He was, they were glad to see, smiling, but only as if the joke was something private between him and Jehovah. By the way, this chapter is also, I believe, the first reference to a brothel in a Doctor Who Target book, Dodo looking, quote, like the proprietress of a broken-down cat house in one of the less selected quarters of New Orleans. Or, as it could have been more simply put, Miss Kitty, the brothel owner in the radio version of Gunsmoke, the best American radio western you should start binge listening, by the way. Chapter 4 introduces, quote, Big Nose Kate Elder, a real person, though referred to as Kate Fisher on TV, a name she also used in real life, and was called as such when Jo Van Fleet played her in the 1957 movie Gunfight at the OK Corral opposite Kirk Douglas. Cotton calls her Fisher on TV, Elder in the novelization. Whichever name, and she used them all, she's fascinating. Born Maria Haroni in Hungary in 1849, immigrated to the U.S. in 1860, but settled in Davenport, Iowa, and not New York City. Many Hungarian immigrants to the U.S. up through World War II were Jewish, though our Kate was likely not with the given name Maria. Kate whitewashed her history, though, in later years claiming to have been American-born, even though she never attained citizenship. She's buried in Prescott, Arizona, under the name Mary Cummings, the quintessential American story. She may have been an eyewitness to the gunfight, and thus in a TV serial based on perceptions of the gunfight but not historical fact. She's one of the truer things in the piece. She lived until 1940, by the way. What a life story. But the book is a parody of a Western, which the TV serial is not. We're told in Chapter 5 that Doc Holliday agrees to marry Kate because he'd rented her company and entertainment, and that's putting it a mite delicate, I'd say, and couldn't pay her, so agreed to marry her instead. Cotton also mentions Kate having taken up with Johnny Ringo and Jesse James, and again mentions Doc Holliday having killed Reuben Clanton. None of this happened in real life, James in particular having no connection to Tombstone, and Reuben Clanton having never existed. Chapter 6 makes a correction. On TV, we're told there's no theater in Tombstone, but Cotton here correctly names the theater the Birdcage, and who was performing in it the last week of October 1881, Eddie Foy, whose son, Eddie Foy Jr., was beloved by my parents for having starred in the Pajama Game, both on Broadway and the theatrical movie, 70 years after this. It's funny how the novelization is such a mix of carefully researched historical fact and carefree fabrication. Chapter 7, Dodo is referred to as a hoyden, a dated expression for a boisterous girl. Donald Cotton loves his arcane vocabulary. He also invents the word dentifactor here, a funny neologism. Cotton refers to the Tombstone newspaper as the Headstone Highlights, which is close. The real paper was called the Tombstone Epitaph, and that's still around, BT Dubs. Its website bills it as Arizona's oldest continuously published newspaper. Now, the New York Post makes that claim for America as a whole. As Chuck D. wrapped an open letter to the New York Post, it's America's oldest continuously published piece of, well, male cow manure. Cotton correctly calls Tombstone Cemetery Boot Hill. The biggest change from the TV for the book is the doctor doesn't walk in on Doc Holliday and Kate in the doc's office, but rather in bed, presumably in mid-activity. This is a much more adult book than, say, Destiny of the Daleks. Professor Barnstorm's musical dogs are mentioned on page 46. I'm at a loss. Lily Langtry, the Jersey Lily, is kept as a pinup by Charlie in the back room of the bar on page 47. I suppose a Wild West barkeep might have heard of an English socialite, though Lily didn't make her stage debut until 3 weeks after the gunfight, so this may be a case of American fictional characters only thinking the thoughts of their British creator. Other cultural allusions are taken from the TV dialogue. A drunken Ike speaks not sotto voce, but blotto voce. Oh, and we learn that Seth also boinked Maria Catalin Haroni, because who hasn't in this novelization? And that's only on page 49. Still, oh my giddy aunt, as somebody once said. Chapter 9, the dialogue is different from TV in two different ways. Cotton doesn't include the TV line about Doc Holliday's daddy being a colonel, because he wasn't, he was a major. And Cotton doesn't include Hartnell's famous reply to goodbye and good luck, or Holliday's tagline from a very funny scene in part 1 on television.
You ain't wearing a gun.
Well, I should hope not. I certainly disapprove of violence.
Now, you can borrow mine.
No.
Now, come along, Pete. Now, you just stand up there. No, you put the holster on it.
I insist.
Now, my gun here has my name printed on it from way down Alabama, where my father was a colonel in the Army. So you can return that to me when you leave Tombstone, which no doubt you will. Now, there you are, sir. You put that in the holster. That's the gentleman's hat, Pete.
Here we are.
There now, ain't he smart? Got it all?
Real cute.
Really, madam.
You come along to your party.
Yes, thank you, you very much, sir. Thank party. You, thank you. I don't know how I shall ever repay you.
You'll find a way to repay me. Goodbye and good luck.
What?
Goodbye and good luck.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, thank you. And the same to you and many of them. Yes, thank you. Goodbye for the moment.
Sure seems a pity he'd bother to have that tooth out.
Chapter 10 is titled A Little Night Music, which is the English translation of a rather famous Mozart composition. In this chapter, rather than aid and abet Doc Holliday's ruse about giving the doctor his gun, Kate pens him a very colorful and nasty note. On page 60, Holliday's internal monologue quotes from both John Wayne in Stagecoach and Browning's Child Roland, To the Dark Tower Came. On page 61, the doctor, accidentally or not, enters a brothel instead of the Last Chance Saloon. The episode 1 cliffhanger, possibly my favorite in all of show history, is considerably altered and minimized. Best line, page 62. So up the stairs she, Dodo, flounced, and Stephen was about to follow her with a more masculine version of the same exit, end quote, when Kate stops him and, quote, took his arm in a way which suggested further favors to come, as Kate makes her way through the whole cast. She directly propositions Stephen on page 74, who is said to panic over the question. See the 1995 missing adventure novel, The Empire of Glass, for more on Stephen's possible romantic preferences, or don't. Great book, though. I suspect, based on my reading of the Ian Potter Mythmaker's Black Archive, that this book, at least for episodes 1 through 3, contains Cotton's draft script dialogue. The TV version would therefore contain last-minute rewrites, ad-libs developed in rehearsal, and thus the TV is much sharper than the book. Let's give a listen to a TV scene that is much improved by the rehearsal and edit process.
Won't you introduce me?
Yeah, give me a pleasure. Doc, I would like you to meet the Clanton brothers.
The Clanton brothers. Oh, dear. I mean, how do you do? Hmm?
Recognize the name, Doc?
Oh, yes, I do indeed, yes. Stephen, don't you think it's time we were going? Hmm?
And not just yet, Doc. We haven't had our little talk about Brother Reuben, the late Brother Reuben.
Oh, yes, I know, yes. Sometimes after a bereavement, it's very difficult to find exactly the right kind of words.
The right words?
Doc, the boys don't want, they don't want words, they want action.
Oh, indeed, yes. Well, if you take my advice, I would leave it in the hands of the right people,
When the right people happen to be your friend Wyatt Earp.
He's not my friend, no. I would rather call him a casual traveling acquaintance.
Well, that ain't the way I heard it.
Nor me.
We heard you and him were close and fleas on a porcupine.
Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday.
Wait a moment. I think I can begin to see your mistake.
It's your mistake that we're interested in, though.
But I am not the Doc. The man you're looking for is the local dentist. Yes. He has a little shop here along the street.
Well, it seems to me that's where I found you.
Yes, well, I can explain that, you see.
And your gun's got his brand on it.
Yes. As a matter of fact, he lent it to me because...
Because what, Doc?
Well, just until I leave the town, as it were.
Hmm? Well, you ain't leaving, Doc.
Live, that is.
Excuse me, gentlemen, they must...
On page 77, Cotton uses the same seven-letter B word that caused such consternation when Ian Martyr used it several years ago now. I have not heard anyone complaining about the word in this book. Kate also believes Doc Holliday's been taking advantage of Dodo and refers to the latter as jailbait. And people complained about the sexual content in the New Adventures novels of the 1990s. This one is practically a French bedroom farce. Chapter 13, Pa Clanton is mentioned as the real big bad behind the Clanton brothers. Cattle rustler, horse thief, stagecoach robber, gold thief, tax fraud, alcoholic, former mayoral candidate. Some of this is true, much of it isn't. The real Pa Clanton, Newman Haynes Clanton, having been shot dead by Mexican militiamen in present-day New Mexico while trying to smuggle cattle into Mexico in real life 10 weeks before the fictional TARDIS materialized in Arizona. Chapter 14, in a twist from the TV, Dodo turns out to be a better poker player than Doc Holliday. Kate references having dated Turkey Creek Johnson, quote, till he got himself hung, page 84. There was a Turkey Creek Johnson, a lawyer, who rode with Wyatt Earp during the Vendetta ride the year after the gunfight, and was indeed a contemporary of Doc Holliday, but he wasn't hung. He died of TB in 1887 in Salt Lake City. In another effort to make the book more historically accurate than the TV, Cotton references both the McLowrys and Morgan Earp, both of whom were involved in real-life events, but none of whom were pictured on TV in 1966. Chapter 15 sadly concludes Shane Rimmer's only 2 weeks on Doctor Who, not counting his coming back to narrate this Target book for the audio range. Harper, while a stupid and weaselly backshooter in the book, was on TV far more honorable than the hired gun who replaces him during the rest of the story, Johnny Ringo. This book also adapts TV scenes without some of their best lines, which must have been added by, Donald Tosh, Jerry Davis, Rex Tucker. People keep giving me guns and I do wish they wouldn't. Or Dodo and Doc Holliday. They've got Steven. They've got my operating chair. The business with the doctor excitedly realizing that he knows how to twirl a gun around his finger. Whoever edited this script for TV had a much more succinct ear for comedy than perhaps did Cotton in the more labored passages of this book. Chapter 16, page 98, contains a gad-awful pun from the 1940s Broadway show Oklahoma. Surrey with a binge on top, Doc Holliday thinks. When my kid and my mother and I all saw Frozen on Broadway in pre-pandemic times at the St. James Theater on West 44th Street, it happened to be the 75th anniversary, to the day, of the Broadway opening of Oklahoma on that same stage. After the Saturday matinee ended, the cast put on a quick medley of songs from the original Oklahoma, which my mother enjoyed far more than she did Frozen. So I have seen this song performed on the Broadway stage, even though I've never seen Oklahoma itself. And by the way, Doctor Who's very own Howard Da Silva was in that opening cast of Oklahoma, March the 31st, 1943. And Eddie Foy, father of a future Broadway star, cameos directly on page 99, and a couple more times after that. On page 101, Bat Masterson stalls for time with the Clanton mob by discussing the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, which of course was still 6 months away from happening in October 1881. Chapter 17. While I find Cotton's similes a little more exhausting than amusing, he actually uses the word dude correctly on page 104 as an insult. Holliday shot Seth Harper, according to Charlie the Barman, quote, as clean as a dude's trousers. The TV line is the less colorful, clean as a whistle. On page 106, we learn that Pa Clanton's wife was buried alive on the Clanton Ranch and died soon thereafter in 1875. Also not true. The former Mariah Kelso died in California in 1866, and I see no record of her having had such a ghoulish exit. Chapter 18, Ringo in the Morning, is the chapter title. I love the TV staging of Lawrence Payne's first scene as Johnny Ringo. And yes, it's coincidence that this is now consecutive novelizations in publication order to feature Payne as a principal TV guest star. For those of you new to the program, 2 weeks ago, book 100 was The Two Doctors. But Payne on TV and Ringo in the book are two very different creatures, or varmints, if you will. In the book, Seth Harper is a backshooter and Ringo is the honorable assassin, a, quote, killer of the old school, Cotton says on page 113. Reading the classics and carrying all 10 volumes of Caesar's De Bello Gallico in his saddlebags, which is odd as they were only 8 volumes. On TV, those positions are flipped, Harper being a moral compass, well, kind of, before Ringo shows up and augurs in the bloodbath. Chapter 19. The reference to Stephen and the Doctor singing The Happy Wanderer is probably anachronistic, the song existing but not in its current and more popular form until the 1940s. On TV, the Doctor recognizes Johnny Ringo immediately, thanks to clever nonverbal business, the Doctor having been seen examining Ringo's wanted poster while in jail in Episode 2. In the book, he has no such realization, though he and Ringo do trade Latin bon mots. Chapter 20, Thought for Feud. Decent pun, chapter title. Morgan Earp is introduced to the narrative in this chapter by his corpse, having been killed by Ike and Billy Clanton the night before. In real life, Morgan Earp did die at the hands of the cowboy gang in March 1882, the beginning of the long afterlife of OK Corral reprisals, which don't happen at all in this TV universe. In the fictional universe, you know who played Morgan Earp in the John Sturges film Gunfight at the OK Corral, which was Cotton's primary source of research for these scripts? DeForest Kelly. Well, crack my knuckles and jump for joy, I got a clean bill of health from Dr. Leonard McCoy himself. Warren Earp appears for the first time in the book too, being a fictional invention of Cotton. Chapter 21, Dodo Draws a Bead. A chapter title similar to coupled chapter titles in the Mythmakers book, although here standing solo. Also, as with Mythmakers, episode 4 basically doesn't exist. Cotton chopping up and reordering scenes, with the episode 3 cliffhanger and Warren Earp's non-existent death both removed. This chapter takes place in the colorfully named Purgatory Bend, Arizona, which seems to be fictional. There is a Purgatory Canyon, Arizona, almost 600 miles away, in the diametrically opposed northwest corner of the state. On page 133, Johnny Ringo recalls Kate's bedroom style as, quote, like a bobcat in a hen coop. And that's putting it to my delicate, I'd say. This scene is also on TV, though the TV scene is a bit more subtly written, and features one of the more poignant verses of the ballad, to which Lawrence Payne times his movements in a nifty bit of little choreography in studio. Chapter 22, The Entry of the Gladiators. Again, the chapter 3 cliffhanger, which doesn't happen in the book, was the death of Warren as the Clanton brothers jailbreak Phineas. Here, Phineas is released on his own recognizance, and Morgan dies off-screen instead. Warren's poignant death on TV caused Wyatt to abandon the law and order the Clantons to the famous gunfight. This chapter instead ends with a comical montage of the parties on their way to the fight, with Kate propositioning Stephen in the event that Johnny Ringo dies. Chapter 23, the final chapter. Episode 4 on TV, as Jim and I said earlier, is dark. Virgil Earp shows up in the first scene, kind of like Han Solo making his triumphant return at the end of, well, the other episode 4. There is no Virgil in the book. The ballad gets its best use as John Alderson slowly loads his revolver, choreographed in sync with the music being played live into the studio by a now defunct job title called the Grams Operator. Gorgeous direction. I can't show you the video, but I can play you the ballad.
Virgil and me's gonna step outside of the law.
I reckon so. Well, I'll tell them. Well, I'll say.
Tell them the OK Corral.
So the Earps and the Clantons are aiming to meet at the OK Corral near Calamity Street. It's the OK Corral, boys, of gunfighting fame, where the Earps and the Clantons, they played out the game. They played out the game, and we never more shall hear a story the like of the OK Corral.
That piano accompaniment is to die for, by the way. Absolutely incredible. Next scene on TV, Ringo violates Seth Harper's code of honor by declaring his plan to win the gunfight dishonorably. Doc Holliday then makes his own Han Solo-esque return to the sheriff's office with that delightful Jackie Lane entrance moment that Jim and I discussed earlier. There's a real sense of building to a dark climax, which in the book becomes parody, with sentences like, quote, the dice were somewhat loaded and blind justice on her pedestal over the courthouse trembled accordingly. The doctor inadvertently fires a shotgun to kick off the battle, an idea that would have worked terribly on TV. The doctor is better served on TV as Bat Masterson's noble but unsuccessful emissary to Pa Clanton trying to stop the fight. A poignant moment with which, I suppose, Donald Cotton would not have been involved. The fight in the book ends with a bullet bouncing off Phineas Clanton's thick cranium, and the sheriff arrests Eddie Foy for no particular reason, right after the doctor, our doctor, nearly put a bullet through the head of Mr. Foy Sr. On TV, the gunfight has dramatic heft. The Clantons dying one by one, the last survivor cornered at the top of a staircase, no way out, Rex Tucker's eagle eye having the cameras pan over the carnage. The book plays this for parody. There's an epilogue in the book too, but quite honestly, I'm ready to move on from Mr. Donald Cotton. What's coming up next on the Doctor Who literature schedule? Shuffles papers. Terence Dix! That should be a straightforward adaptation of a simple and much-loved tale. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, The Time Monster. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Doctor Who Literature. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. The ballad at the beginning was also written and performed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Jim Sangster. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and YouTube at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
They paid for their sin and they lost on the draw. For the herbs they was faster and they was the law. So beware all you cowboys who's yearning to sin. If the herbs is the lawman, you ain't gonna win.
Direction Point. A Doctor Who Podcast Network.